Thank you very much, Ryan Burroughs. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN, 1211 on this Wednesday afternoon. Now, as I said earlier, a little bit later, we'll go down to Austin, Texas. Michael Heidemann, the former producer of the Biz Lunch, is down there. He's sort of a South by Southwest guy, and he's been checking in with some of the tech and innovation news coming out of South by Southwest, and so we'll hear from him a little bit later. Frank Sennett will be here as well. Maybe check a little politics. We got a couple other candidates for governor in the race. That's after the break, but we always start on Wednesdays with Terry Savage. You can read some of her columns. We'll talk about one a little bit later at terrysavage.com. Terry, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Always glad to be here, especially on a Fed day, because everybody's just sort of holding their breath.
It seems like
it's not going to be much of a shock.
I was going to say, it seems like every day is a Fed day for the past year and a half. And we widely expect we'll be shocked. People will be falling down if they don't increase interest rates right about the time we say goodbye this afternoon, right?
Exactly. Just an hour from now, a little less than an hour from now. You know, it could be a quarter point, maybe a half point increase in the Fed funds rate. The language of the commentary will be, you know, parsed down to every little word. What are they saying they're seeing? There's a lot of evidence that the Fed is really ready to move, not only today, but more than today. The street's betting on three times this year.
Do you think there could be a half point increase today?
I doubt they would do that. I think they would like to do a more measured increase. But you asked me what could be the surprise. The biggest surprise, of course, was no action. That just won't happen. But a half a point increase might really shock everybody. Or some of their language saying, well, here's our plan. You know, we haven't got strong economic growth. Now, there was a report out this morning. The first quarter GDP is still going to be less than 1%. But we do have signs of inflation. We had the producer price up 2.2% annual rate. Today, the consumer price index now at 2.7% annual rate. Remember, it wasn't that long ago we were talking about deflation. But let me come full circle on that. A big part of those price increases was soaring energy prices, which oil was over $54 a barrel. Now oil is about $48 a barrel. Amidst a huge glut in the world and fracking and the headlines in the Wall Street Journal, natural gas glut, it's been a warm winter. So you have this kind of rolling cycle. Okay, we have growth not so strong, but we have signs of inflation. But that came from oil, which was up, but now it's not. So this is a very delicate art, or maybe it's just a good guess on the part of the Fed as to what to do and how much to do and how often to do it this year.
And so if they do increase rates now and then maybe one more time this year, have they done one this year already? I've lost track
already. No, December, but it was the end
December.
Of the year.
Okay,
last December they raised rates, and it was the first time actually, the second time in 9 years. So the fact is the Fed's been pretty cautious all this way. They've huffed and puffed and talked about it a lot more than they've actually done anything.
And so if it does go up this month, you know, I'm just thinking of people buying or selling homes. There's a story in Cranes today about how there's kind of a glut of high-end homes in Lincoln Park right now. I would imagine that the incentive to sell or buy quickly would be increased.
Well, yes, because, well, first of all, that the Fed's increase in rates will translate all down the line, and that will translate to the 10-year Treasury on which mortgage rates are based in. I mean, but the whole world has known for the last couple of months that mortgage rates are going up a bit. So that also shouldn't be much of a surprise. High-end homes, I think that's a question of will the economy grow? Will taxes be cut? Will they come to some smart accommodation on health care? So I think that's the hesitancy. We haven't seen it in the market. I mean, the market's just kind of holding in here. It's not soaring anymore, but it's certainly been up a lot. The rest of the economy, you know, home builders are optimistic.
I just was going to say, they were out with their sentiment today, and it's the most optimistic in the past 12 years, so that's good news.
Well, yeah, but they tend to be, I hate to say this, I don't want to insult any of my home builder friends, but they tend to be most optimistic at the top. And so, I mean, that doesn't call a top, but I'm just saying that that's how we got left with excesses of inventory and homes and land the last time. I'm not calling this a bubble,
wow,
but a higher interest rate could impact people's decisions, either make them run to go do it now, especially at the lower end where every point or quarter point in interest rates changes your affordability to get a mortgage.
But, you know, but really, if they go up a quarter point, if the interest rate goes up a quarter point, the impact on, I mean, it seems like it's going to be a pretty small immediate impact on mortgage rates, right? I don't see that being a make or break.
If you're talking about 4.5, 4.75% even, we both remember back. I mean, I remember back to double-digit mortgage rates.
Oh, so
and
do I.
I remember thinking 9% was really a great deal. So everything is relative, but we have a generation of new home buyers who are cautious. They're not, you know, we have a change in psychology. Do I want to rent or buy? And so the idea that rates will go up, I'll tell you one other thing, though. Just put this thought in your mind, everyone out there. Everybody who took out home equity loans 10 years ago, 9 years ago, will have a reset coming due when that bubble pops. At that point, you not only have to refinance your loan, but you probably have to come up with a payment of principal plus equity. So those monthly payments will go up. It won't be interest only. So that's coming down the pike for housing, too.
Hey, I learned something today. The state of New York, you know, releases the bonuses for Wall Street every year as part of the, I don't know how long they've been doing that, but the total Wall Street bonuses last year was $23.9 billion, which is a lot of money. I think it was the first increase since 2012. But what I didn't realize, I knew that the financial sector was big in New York. I didn't realize this story I'm reading at CNBC.com that private, let me find it, the statistic exactly, the financial industry accounts for 1/5 of private sector wages in New York City. I had no idea it was that significant.
Oh, sure, absolutely, because the rest of New York City is mostly government sector wages.
Oh,
and the
okay.
Well, the publishing industry, the clothing and fashion industry. But sure, and it's highly weighted in New York to financial services. That is, you know, the financial capital of the world, not only the U.S.
I guess so, but I mean, $1 in $5 earned in private wages goes to the financial sector. That's a big chunk. I mean, that is there any other city that has that big of an influence from a single industry? I'm asking out loud. Maybe it's a stupid question. Terry, are you there? That was such a stupid question that Terry Savage hung up on me. That's never happened before, but it probably will happen again. It's 12:22. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, just before the break, I was saying something that I thought was particularly insightful, and Terry Savage hung up on me. So we'll see if she's back on the phone line. Terry, have you rejoined us? Terry, did you hang up on me? What happened there?
No, you hung up on me.
I don't think I did. No, but so I want to talk about the this price war going on. But before that, it did strike me that, I mean, is there, I guess if you look at some other industry, whether it's timber out in the Northwest or whatever, there are certainly individual economies that have great impacts on cities. But the idea that 20% of the income comes from the financial district, I don't know. I can't quite get over that.
Well, get over it. I mean, in Houston, the economy spins on the oil industry.
Okay, there you go.
And they can go from being wealthy and shopping in 1 minute to being, you know, busted and homes on the market in another. So it's, those are the sectors of the economy. And there's places where travel, after 9/11, when you couldn't travel, Las Vegas was hit dramatically. Nobody's surprised to think that, you know, a huge portion of the income, not only of the hotels and people who work there in Las Vegas, is tourist-related. So New York is financially based. Wall Street thinks it's worth that, and America continues to pay them that, except that you might not have to, and that was the point of one of my most recent columns.
Well, you know, I've been seeing the ads on TV, and they're talking about these different big firms, about how much they're charging for trades, you know, and I don't even know which is which, but there's one with a billboard outside another office, and all this competition where they're really selling themselves not on their great insight or wisdom, but by how much they're charging customers, and there's a reason for that.
Or how little, yeah.
Or how little.
It's a price war going on. Now, look, let's start with one assumption. Everybody in general has given up on the idea of beating the market, and all the professionals are going to indexing. You have big college endowments that say, well, we're not going to hire people to manage our money and pick stocks and investments for us. We aren't using hedge funds anymore. We're just something I've been saying for like 25 years. You don't have to beat the market. Just be there, and you'll do fine. So nobody's touting their research or we pick hot stocks or the last five stocks we pick double. That's not what's going on. People are going, okay, I just want to be in the market, and I want to be in the market at the lowest cost. So that's why you have places like Vanguard, you have places like Fidelity, now touting the fact that they are actually the least expensive place to trade by a half of a cent. It's a real price war going on.
Tell me about the difference.
I get a lot of questions from people. Is 1%, is 2% too much? Vanguard's website has a good, you'll see on my column, there's a link. Go to Terry Savage, you can read the column. The next, if you earn 6% a year for the next 25 years and had no costs or fees, and you put $100,000 in, it would be worth $430,000 just earning 6%. Remember, average historically is closer to 10 with dividends reinvested. But if you paid 2% a year in costs after 25 years, instead of 430, you'd have only $260,000. It's a real impact to pay a lot in costs, either upfront costs or ongoing management fees. And now you have companies like Fidelity and Vanguard going, right, we know we need to educate you about costs. So we're going to make it a public issue.
So if you have a choice, is one better than the other, the initial upfront cost rather than the ongoing management fees?
You shouldn't be paying any of those costs. This is what I've been trying to say forever and ever and ever. There is $3 trillion in IRAs now, a lot of it rolling out as people retire, as people have to take withdrawals, as people move out of their 401ks and roll over into IRAs. And without that fiduciary rule, there's a whole army of salespeople out there. They bury their costs. You don't notice that there's a big upfront fee that goes to the broker or ongoing management fees of 1% or 2% a year. It's always worth paying to get good advice, but most people aren't sophisticated to know if the advice is good.
All right, Terry Savage. I'm sorry, Terry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but we're about out of time.
And I know you're out.
The Fed's going to...
You're on my hot button, Steve. Don't pay a lot for investment advice. Fidelity and Vanguard and T. Rowe Price will do a great job for you.
All right, the Fed will announce in about 40 minutes or so. You think it's going to be probably 0.25%?
Probably 0.25%, but I just, if it's a half, call me back.
All right, we'll talk to you. Terry Savage, nice to see you. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks, yes.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand or on Facebook. I have a public page, Steve Bertrand, so keep in touch there. Frank Sennett is on a phone line. Frank is the Director of Digital Strategy at Crane Chicago Business and joins us from time to time. Frank Sennett, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, where do you want to start? Let's do politics because we talk a lot on this show about Illinois' political situation and leadership, maybe problems with leadership or frustrations with leadership. I don't know. We got a race for governor coming up and another Democrat who is kind of throwing his hat into the ring or throwing his hotels into the ring. I don't know. What's he throwing into the ring, Frank?
That's right. J.B. Pritzker has created a gubernatorial exploratory committee. I've been practicing saying that for about an hour.
Nice
and
job.
He put $200,000 of his own money in to just decide whether he wants to run for governor next year.
Well, he can afford to do that, right? He's not going to miss that $200,000.
Yeah, he's got some hotel revenue coming in. So, it's the battle of the billionaires shaping up. We've got Governor Rauner, of course, the incumbent. We have Chris Kennedy, who is also in the ring on the Democratic side. And if Pritzker comes in, that's three rich guys. And then the fourth guy in the equation would be Alderman Mayor Poir, who last I checked was not a billionaire, but he also can't even get free White Sox tickets, we found out, with the ethics scandal.
That was a story yesterday about how the Chicago Ethics Office, I don't know the exact name of it, suggested that the Alderman not take free tickets for the Sox opener along with food and drink, because if you add it all up, it would get to maybe $50 and that would kick in their gift ban.
As a Cubs fan, did you almost felt like you had to throw out the notion that I thought the ethics rules only covered things of value, gifts of value. But
Frank.
I'll be here all week.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the city should do all it can to get people into the park. So I think we should encourage the Alderman to take a payoff and go check out the game.
I agree.
It's a nice place, and no one knows what it's
and
called anymore.
I love the scout seats down there, boy. That's that's living.
The,
they don't have anything like that at Wrigley yet.
They're switching to Modelo, right? So that's not all bad. What's it called? Bank rate, cut rate, bank. I don't even know.
Yeah.
Guaranteed rate.
Guaranteed rate. Yeah. And then they've got the, if they've got the Modelo Negro, I'm there. And me in the scout seats. Sounds good.
We'll have to do that. Okay. Weren't we talking about the race for governor, though? So
yeah. So we got these three rich guys squaring off against each other, perhaps.
We might have Robin Kelly, Kurt Summers in as well, Chicago Treasurer Kelly. And, well, Andy Maynard is in the news today, state senator, where he is pushing legislation to make it easier for people to vote or be registered to vote. So maybe he's got something in mind for himself there.
Yeah, it could be a pretty crowded field. I think people are sensing weakness in the current state house setup with the stalemate between the legislature and the governor. And, you know, there's where they smell blood in the water. There's a lot of people stepping up to take a plunge.
All right. We'll see how that works out and see whether anyone else would enter the race there coming up. I want to talk about this group as well that is it's called Thrive Chicago. And its effort is to what? Identify 10,000 unemployed young people in Chicago. They're unemployed, not in school. And it sounds like sort of to foster them into careers. I'm not sure I exactly understand it. Explain it for me.
Yeah, so Thrive Chicago has a goal of by 2020, so not that long, 3 years from now, getting 10,000 unemployed young adults who are at risk in Chicago, get them reconnected to their communities, get them job training, get them education, and the connections they need to get good jobs. So they would be age 16 to 24, and folks who are neither in school nor at work may have had some trouble with the law. And wanting to reach out and saying economic development, giving these folks opportunities is the way probably to combat some of the horrible crime problems that we've seen and give people some hope.
Is this a unique effort in Chicago or has it been done elsewhere?
I think it has been done successfully, I think, in Boston and New York, you know, this kind of collective action. And there are some other efforts in Chicago along these lines. In fact, Crane Chicago Business former publisher David Snyder recently took the job as COO of an organization called CRED that's headed by Arne Duncan, the former education secretary, funded by Steve Jobs' widow. And they have a similar mission here in Chicago to go into these at-risk communities and get people some economic development. So we definitely have some political will and some financial muscle behind some of this. Now we'll see how it works.
I certainly hope it works. I hope they succeed. But it's got to be hard. I mean, right? Because if it was easy, groups like this and others would have had some more success in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, right? I mean, it's like you have to start with education and economic development. But if, you know, this generation's already, you know, not been served well enough, not had the opportunities, and they may be lost to a certain extent. I mean, where do you start? You don't want to put everybody in jail. You want to give them a chance and hopefully within this next generation, they can, you know, put enough muscle in to turn it around. But to your point, if it was easy to solve, it would have been solved.
Well, let's hope that they do solve it, because wouldn't it be great if some of those 10,000 were, you know, look, a lot of them have been written off. So these groups are not doing that. They are investing in them, and hopefully they'll succeed and one day maybe compete to go to the Booth School of Business or Northwestern's Kellogg or something like that. I know there just was a ranking up by U.S. News and World Report on business schools around the country, and Chicago does pretty well in those surveys.
Yeah, and it's usually a battle of the two titans in this market, University of Chicago's Booth School and Northwestern University's Kellogg. Go Wildcats, I have to say that contractually.
Yeah.
Usually Booth comes out ahead, and right now they still are, but they're in third place. From a tie for second last year, but Kellogg has moved up to a tie for fourth place. So they're only one notch behind Booth on the battle of the business schools.
And they break it down then within different sorts of business. I think the U of I does well when it comes to accounting, as I recall from reading the article. So it breaks down, but overall, if you could go anywhere, you want to go to U of C or Northwestern, I guess, if you can't get into Harvard.
Yeah.
Harvard's number one all the time.
And then Wharton is tied with them for the top spot.
Donald Trump went, right?
That's right. But, yeah. I mean, if you look at even local programs like Notre Dame, UIC, or, I mean, sort of University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, you know, they're still very highly ranked. So we've got a really potent group of business schools in this area.
University of Illinois-Champaign is 40th overall, and the University of Wisconsin is at 34th, I think.
Yeah, and Notre Dame's at 25th.
All right, and so bottom line, though, there are a lot of nice choices around here. If you want to go to a marquee name, you've got some opportunities. And you went to a marquee name, right? Northwestern, Medill, look at that. Do you say that all the time when you meet people? I went to Northwestern, Medill?
No, I will just root for the Wildcats when they do well in football and basketball.
How are you spending your Thursday afternoon?
I may be bending an elbow at a local watering hole near your studio.
That sounds like research to me. You already got your spot picked out?
Yeah, I think we're going to go, our sales staff, Cranes, I think we're all going to go as a little team building exercise, and I'll show them the beauties of Northwestern basketball.
Every game won by the Wildcats is good for all of us, no matter where we went. Frank Sennett, nice to talk to you again.
Thanks, Steve.
So it's a wearable glove device for dancers. Think about it as a minority report for dancers. It detects my movement, finger movement as well. And so it lights up differently based on that. I can control lights as well as external sounds all from my glove while I dance.
South by Southwest is back in Austin, celebrating 30 years of one of the nation's first music festivals, which has now exploded into an innovative hub, showcasing some of the hottest startups on a truly global scale.
I'm a graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin.
And we're from Tokyo.
My name is Ludwig Dumont, and I'm sitting here at the Belgian Pavilion. And basically, it's to showcase that we have more to offer in Belgium than only fine chocolates and fine beers.
So people come for the pint Guinness and stay for the incredible, innovative Irish companies.
That's the work of Michael Heidemann, who is working extra hard this week down in Austin, Texas, at the South by Southwest Festival, former producer for this program, and he joins us on a phone line now. Michael, are you there?
Steve, it's great to hear you.
I don't know. I heard a montage there, and I heard a couple things specific to text, but I think I heard more things specific to beer there. What's going on?
Well, they need to have something to draw the consumers in. So they're either using swag or liquidations, I suppose. It's been great here.
Well, that's right. And not insignificant, the fact that Chicago used to have a bigger presence. They would have they were indoors for a while and had an outdoor tent, I think, last year, maybe the last couple of years. They kind of bagged it this year. But you're seeing a lot of different governments or areas kind of touting themselves down there.
Yeah, well, when Chicago was here for the first few years, about in 2013, I believe that they had, or 2013 or 14, they had Rahm Emanuel come for the Chicago-made portion of the festival, which was a great booth, lots of great Chicago artists, and then, yeah, like you mentioned, they had the tent last year, and now it's just so oversaturated with all these different parts of the country, and especially parts of the world that are showcasing their new products that, I don't know. I guess Chicago took a back seat this year, but it's phenomenal to see, you know, people from Australia, from China, from Korea bring in these innovative products to like this mecca of techies and people who are going to be using these products in the next few years. So it's a phenomenal thing here at South by Southwest.
All right, but so help us understand it a little bit, because I mean I've been to Austin a couple times, and I think of the music festival and all these people sort of wandering around outside. When it comes to the tech show and the tech part of it, is it like inside in a convention center? Is that where you're bumping into people? Are there music festivals outside, or how does the whole geography of it work?
Yeah, so I guess I could explain it as if so downtown Chicago was taken over by a big music festival. It happens every year with Lollapalooza. But everything would be kind of centered in the merchandise mart, and then you'd be able to see, you know, all these great tech startups and everything, while Michigan Avenue would be like 6th Street here in Austin with music playing everywhere. So during the day, you go to the Austin Convention Center here on East Cesar Chavez Street in Austin, and you're surrounded by this beautiful brisket smell in the air, and there's trains going by, people are busking on the street, there's music everywhere. I most likely have a water and a sandwich in my hand
before noon.
Yes, I try. And you go to the convention center and you'll be able to see convocations by speakers. I mean, I was able to see Joe Biden speak on his Moonlight Initiative, or Moonshot Initiative, which is going to be tackling cancer with new data research. And then I saw Mark Cuban speak the other day about how the disruptive atmosphere in our political sphere is really taking the forefront in how, you know, companies like Uber were able to disrupt the transportation here in America, and how other companies are looking to kind of disrupt the fact that we're looking for more ways to get more excited about, you know, or to ways to kill time better, more entertainment-based things. So that's why I'm seeing a lot of virtual reality here, as well as interactive, like the guy who had the gloves,
right,
that could help you dance. There's a lot of those kind of products that are helping you kill time with people around you.
It's interesting, cool. Interesting that Cuban's talking about Uber, and Uber's not even legal in Austin, right? How are you millennials getting around? Do you know how to hail a cab? Have you done that before?
Steve, I feel like a caveman down here. I'm just like punching buttons into my phone to try to figure out how I can get around. Yeah, Uber and Lyft went through some political strife over the past year, and they actually left the city of Austin, which, you know, from a guy from Chicago, that's all I use.
Right.
So down here they have these two things called, they have a few things, actually, which Ride Austin is what I've been using lately, and there's another app called Fasten. But this is a cool thing because it's, you know, Uber and Lyft are gone. They're national companies, but these are very Austin-based companies now. So it's really, you know, putting their feet to the fire as far as, you know, using Austin, Texas tech to really fix this problem of not having a rideshare service.
Michael,
but for me from Chicago, yes.
I was going to say, Michael Heidemann's on the phone line from South by Southwest. We just have a few seconds left. What is it you think you'll bring home with you? What's going to make the impact?
I'm going to bring you home a brisket sandwich.
That will make an impact on me.
So good. But what I've been seeing most is going to be making an impact is the fact that a lot of interaction is happening with communication and technology. So I think that you're going to be seeing a lot more VR. It's not really at the place it wants to be right now, but in the next 10 years, I'm sure they're going to pin it down. But a lot more data-based products, you know, ways that you can communicate with people, whether it be through Snapchat, Instagram, or a new product that we haven't even seen yet. So look forward to that.
Great to talk to you, Michael. Enjoy it. Soak up every minute.
Steve, great talking to you, too.